Now, I have 2 points for you in this hour. I will tell you right now what they are, because I'm not trying to be sly or elusive, and that you can write them down and you won't miss them. Here are my 2 points. Number one, and you've heard this before, number one, ideas have consequences and bad ideas have bad ones. That's point one. Ideas have consequences, bad ideas have bad ones. Here's point two. Sloppy language makes sloppy thought possible. Ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have bad ones. And sloppy language makes sloppy thought possible. Those are my 2 points. I will have succeeded if, when we're done, you believe those 2 statements are true. I'm going to try to prove those 2 statements are true to you by talking about meaning. Now, before I talk about meaning, I have to set the table, so to speak, and tell you something that probably, upon careful reflection, you already know is true. You already know that there are people at large in the world who hate the Western tradition in general and hate the United States in particular. They want to destroy that tradition, and they want to destroy and undermine that nation. And they do it in more ways than one. Some of our enemies are overt. That is, you know what they're up to when they're doing it. They fly airplanes into skyscrapers. That's not subtle. They fly airplanes into skyscrapers at the World Trade Center because they want to strike at the heart of the West's financial power. They fly planes into the Pentagon. Why? Because they want to strike at the heart of the West's military power. And if, as we think, the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania was heading for the Capitol or the White House, it's because they were hoping to strike at the heart of the West's political power. And so, yeah, they're out to undermine us, and it's quite obvious what the agenda is. But not everybody who's out to undermine Western tradition does it in quite that overt fashion. Some of those who undermine the Western tradition and America do so more covertly. That is, it's not quite so obvious what they're up to, but they're up to it. And by that I mean they use hermeneutics. That's just a 50-cent word for the rules of interpretation. They're going to change the way that texts are understood. Why? Because they know that the Western tradition is based upon the great books and the great ideas that are in the great books. It's the great ideas that make the great books great. But let's say you're a person who doesn't like Western tradition, who doesn't like the great books because, you know, they were written by dead white European males, and that's the enemy. And so you have to figure out some way of shutting them up. But you just can't burn down the libraries where all the books are being housed, because then they would know what you're up to. What you have to do instead is change the way people read those books. Go after hermeneutics. Go after meaning. Now, let's see. Can I have a volunteer? Just someone to give me a 3 or 4 word sentence. I don't even care what it says. Anybody want to do that? Nobody? Christian virtue does not include cowardice. I said 3 or 4 words. 4 score isn't a sentence. Just give me a 3 or 4 word sentence. That's a sentence.
All men should be free.
All men should be free. You know what that means to me, Dave? Phillies are going to win the pennant. Isn't that what that sentence means? So that's okay with you. You can say all men should be free, and I can say that means the Phillies will win the pennant, and that's okay with you. Or do you want to say, no, I wasn't talking about the National League East. I was talking about human nature needing to be free. Now, they want you, the liberals want you to say, yeah, words mean whatever the interpreter says they mean. To modernists and postmodernists, meaning equals interpretation. Meaning's interpretation to postmodernists, which means that since there are multiple interpreters and multiple interpretations, every text has multiple meanings. It's just up to you to decide which one it is. Now, when I say to Dave, when he says human beings ought to be free, if I say to him that means the Phillies are going to win the pennant, do you see what I've done or tried to do? I've tried to shut him up. You can thank me later. But that's the intention. When you let the reader determine the meaning and not the author, it shuts up the author. If you don't like what people like Shakespeare and Wordsworth and Milton and Sidney and Spencer and Dante have said, all you have to do to shut them up is to say that the text means whatever the interpreter says it means and not what the author intends it to mean. I was in a debate once with a feminist professor at Princeton, and she went first, and she explained why she thought this was true. Meaning equals interpretation. Meaning doesn't equal the author's or the speaker's intention. So when she went first and she spoke for 5 or 10 minutes, whatever it was, and then sat down. Then I went to the podium and said, thank you, Professor so-and-so, for agreeing with me that meaning equals the author's intention. She said, that's not what I meant. So I said it again for effect so that people wouldn't miss the point. Thanks for agreeing with me that meaning equals the author's intention. She couldn't defend herself without agreeing that I was right. I just did to her what she tried to do to the great books. I took her words away from her. Like they want to do to Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas or Edmund Burke or whomever. And so, let's just do a thought experiment. Let's see what would happen if meaning equals interpretation. If ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have bad ones, and if sloppy language makes sloppy thought possible, what would happen in a world where meaning really were interpretation? Let's just see where that goes. Number one, what would happen to teaching if meaning were interpretation? Well, you'd have to conclude that graded instruction was unfair. Can you see why? Because if, let's say you're taking an essay final in your course, and you write essay answers out on your page, if meaning's interpretation, your answer means what your teacher says it means, because your teacher's the interpreter. Well, wait a second. How can your teacher mark your answer down and give you a bad grade if your answer means what she says? Wouldn't that mean that she was failing her own course? How can she say meaning's interpretation, interpret your text, and then give you a failing grade or an A? Because if she gives your answer the right meaning, it's still not you, but you still get the grade. It doesn't seem to mix. How can you teach and grade if you say meaning's interpretation? And if meaning's interpretation, what does the test question mean? What you, the interpreter, says it means. Oh, they don't like that. What does the course syllabus mean? Whatever you say it means, because you're the reader. See, they don't want you to do to their words what they want to do to somebody else's words. You have to make them play fair. Everybody in the classroom plays by the same rules. What would happen to libraries if meaning were interpretation? Well, if no book has a meaning until a reader gives it one, well, then a library is just a collection of 800,000 meaningless texts. Meaningless until some college freshman comes along and gives it a meaning. Now, you probably have seen college freshmen before. And you know that they are frequently silly, vapid, undereducated, self-indulgent people who don't know anything. When they're sober. Which isn't always. What sort of meaning would the silly, vapid, undereducated, pointy-headed, self-indulgent, sober people give these texts? Something that reflected them. Now, if you don't like the great books of the Western world, something good just happened. You were able to pull the plug on all the great books, let the meaning drain away, and let idiots put something different in its place. If you, however, think the great books are important and the meaning of the great books ought to be preserved, this is a catastrophe. Because now your culture is being taken from you. It's being attacked covertly from the inside. Nobody's flying planes into skyscrapers, but they're doing something just and equally as devastating. Because these folks know that cultures depend for their foundation on ideas. And if you can get rid of the ideas and the books that have those ideas in them, you can get rid of the culture because it will collapse under its own weight. That's the point. That's what they're trying to do by changing the meaning of meaning and calling it interpretation. More thought experiment. What would happen to rape if meaning were interpretation? Well, rape would become impossible, wouldn't it? Why? Because no doesn't mean no. It means whatever the interpreter says it means. Oh, she said no. Maybe she even shouted no. But I know that no means yes. Because I'm the interpreter. So you tell me, in the world in which you really live, is rape possible or impossible? If this is how it works, rape is gone. What would happen to the Constitution if meaning were interpretation? What would happen is what actually did happen to the Constitution. Think of the Roe v. Wade decision that was given in the early 1970s. That decision was written for the majority by Justice Blackmun. Justice Blackmun learned how to read in an English class where he heard that meaning was interpretation. And when he got to law school, he heard the same thing over again. The law means what the judges say it means. And so, he'll say things like, there are what he calls, others call penumbral rights. Penumbra just means shadowy. In the Constitution, there are certain penumbral, shadowy, unarticulated rights. Inside these shadowy, unarticulated, penumbral rights is the right to privacy. Inside the right to privacy, this shadowy, unarticulated, penumbral right, is the right to have an abortion without state interference in the first two trimesters of pregnancy and with state approval in the third trimester, because then the state has a controlling interest. Well, now, see, you could read the Constitution 100 times a day for 100 years and find nothing there about penumbral rights, privacy, trimesters, all that. It's not there. But it doesn't have to be there if you're Justice Blackmun, because it means whatever you say. Because meaning's interpretation. And you see what happens? By doing it that way, you get to shut up the framers or the founders because you don't like what they say. Hermeneutics does all kinds of work for you if you're a postmodernist. I told this story last night. I'll tell it again in case you weren't here, but I don't mean to bore the rest of you. You know where the punchline's coming, so just be patient and let an old man repeat himself. But you'll recall that I said last night that in a fit of insanity, I once decided to go back to school and get a master's degree in public administration, and that I was the only person in that public administration school that didn't work for the state of Michigan, because I'm a theologian. And that means that almost certainly there's going to be a clash of worldviews. You know, bureaucrats and I. And so in the very first day of the very first course, which was a course on public health administration, the professor was talking about how much better health care was in Cuba than it is in America. Better doctors and nurses, better hospitals, better drugs, better prices, longer life expectancy. Which, if you're me, that pulls a trigger. And I want to say stuff. And so I raised my hand and said, you know, Dr. Syed, it just seems like a mystery to me. Why, since things are so much better in Cuba than they are in America, why all those Cuban folks would risk their lives crossing the ocean in leaky boats just to come to Florida in order to die younger? And he said, what are you getting at? Like, you know, what's my point? See, I thought the point was relatively obvious, but he's not really good with meaning. So I explained to him why healthcare in America was better. And he said, where'd you get your information? I said, the government accounting office. He said, you can't trust that because it's political. Oh, where'd you get yours? And he said, the United Nations. So then he tells me, Mike, you don't understand that the human beings are the epiphenomenon of society. Well, that's an interesting big word. Epiphenomenon. He just said, I'm an epiphenomenon. Now, that sounds good. Like, I'm not just a phenomenon. I'm an epiphenomenon. You think, thank you, Dr. Syed. That was nice of you to say. But that's not what the word means, see, like we said last night. An epiphenomenon is a secondary or derivative existence. It owes its very existence to something else. And he just said that human beings are the epiphenomenon of society, which means I owe my very existence to society. When society gets together, human beings are formed. And I said, no, that's backwards. It's when human beings get together, society is formed. Society is the epiphenomenon. Think in the way you do. When your version of society gets threatened, someone's going to have to die, right? He said, yeah, sometimes people have to die. And all the other people in the room who work in healthcare in Michigan for the government are nodding their heads, yes, sometimes people have to die. So, being an incurable smart aleck, I just said to them, I assume from your agreement that you're all in veterinary medicine, which offended them because they weren't veterinarians. We work with people. I said, you don't think like it. When you take your dog Spot to the vet looks at Spot and says, well, Spot's got this and this problem and it's going to cost $400 to fix it. What would you like to do? And the vet asks you, not Spot, because you're the one paying the bills. Now, if you don't have any money, that's tough luck for Spot. And I just want you to know, in government-sponsored healthcare, you are Spot. Because when the people in charge of the healthcare budgets want to please their bosses, they have to do their budget things in the right way. And if you can't keep your budget in check, it puts more pressure on the guy above you. And so you try to impress your boss and save money. And you know that old Joe is just an epiphenomenon. Now, old Joe, being old, has this problem that the great majority, between 75 and 90%, the great majority of your life's medical expenses come due in the last couple years of your life. When you're old, you're expensive. And if the government is paying for your health care, and you owe your existence to the society, well, then they're going to decide that the time has come for you to cash in the chips and go do the right thing. Please die. And they'll make sure that that's what happens. And I'm just telling you that you have to fight for every word, whether it's the word epiphenomenon or even any of the words in the Constitution, if you don't fight for every word, somebody's going to die. That's why Confucius said a long time ago, when words lose their meaning, people lose their lives. So, save somebody's life by saving a word. What would happen to the Bible if meaning were interpretation? Well, you'd have to say, wouldn't you, that God was a fool? Why? Well, silly God, he actually thought he was telling you something in the Bible. Apparently, God hadn't read all the latest French and German literary critics. He didn't know that meaning was up to you. He didn't know that the Bible means whatever you say it means. Well, you might think it's crazy to call God a fool, but just think of this. The last time you went to a Bible study, didn't somebody say, "So, Richie, what does this verse mean to you?" And Richie answered the question. Instead of saying, "Who gives a spit what it means to me? I didn't write it. Let's see if we can figure out what I meant to Luke or John or Paul, whoever it was the author." What I'm telling you is that postmodernism has worked itself into evangelical Bible studies too. And that's not the good news. What would happen to conversations if meaning were interpretation? Well, conversations become monologues. He can say whatever he wishes, and it might be perfectly sensible. But that doesn't matter, because I'm in charge, I'm the interpreter. It only matters what I want to talk about. We're going to talk about the Phillies. And so, it's not really a conversation anymore, it's just a monologue. It's just me, capturing and commandeering somebody else's words for my own purposes. And that's what they want. They want to commandeer the words of the Bible, of the framers, of the great books, and make those words do whatever they themselves want them to do. If meaning's interpretation, misunderstandings aren't possible. If meaning's interpretation, the speaker can't say, "That's not what I meant." Because meaning isn't the speaker's prerogative. It's the listener's prerogative, or the reader's prerogative, and I get to say who's right, because I'm in charge. See, if you're a postmodernist, you don't like authority. You want to be the authority. You want to be the person in charge. You'll notice that the word authority derives from the word author. It's the authors have to go. If meaning's interpretation, messages aren't possible. David can't say what he wants to say about human beings and freedom, because what his words will communicate isn't up to him. In this system, it's up to me. And so he can't pass on any message. All I get to do is tell you what I think and want. What would happen if meaning were interpretation, like this says, what would happen to this lecture? When it was over, you could tell me what it meant. And then I'd tell you what your interpretation meant. And we'd all be surprised. So ask yourself, is that how words really work? Or are these guys living in a fantasy world that they hope to create in order to make their version of reality real? That man I mentioned to you last night, Morris Kelly, who talked about people being proof. Morris was, in his day, maybe the America's leading authority on the thought of the poet John Milton. Morris died a few years ago at the age of 95. Back in the 1930s, when Morris was a young man just starting his career at Princeton, his big goal was, I want to go to England and I want to work with Milton's manuscripts in my own hands. And so he applied for grants and he saved money and he made all the arrangements until finally he could do it. He went to England, and on the very first day in England, even before he went to the flat that he had rented, he went right to the British Museum and called up Milton's manuscripts. And they bring them out, and Morris sits down at his desk, and here's the dream come true. He's got Milton's manuscripts right there in front of him. He's a happy guy. And about 5 o'clock, when the time comes to close down the museum, the people that work there are, you know, kind of shuffling people out the front door so they can all go home. And at 5 o'clock, when Morris goes out the front door, he notices that it's raining outside. It rains in London. Maybe you've heard that. And poor Morris can't find two things. He can't find his umbrella, and he can't find the flat he rented. Well, that's a tough combination. So he just starts to walk, hoping for the best. And here he is, you know, cursing his fates, because I don't know where I'm going. I'm getting soaked. I don't have an umbrella. And he turns this little London side street, and on an overhead shop sign, he sees these words: "Umbrellas recovered." He's thinking, cool. Maybe this man can help me recover mine. And then he realizes, because remember, in those days, Morris was one of these guys. And he says, then I realized that recovered did not mean, you know, retrieved. It meant repaired or refurbished. And no matter how bad I wanted to meet something else, it just could not. He said, at that moment, I stopped being a cultural liberal because I figured out how words work. So, let's see, I'll turn this page over. Let's just make an illustration of how words actually work. This is Sally, and this, well, you know, Sally doesn't really have a hole in her head. Sam probably does. This is Sally, and this is Sam. And let's just say that this Sally, she's smart, you know. She's the kind of person, her head's cooking. She's always thinking something. And it's usually pretty good. And lately, what Sally's been thinking about is the letter R. You ever thought about the letter R? You never watched Sesame Street? So she's thinking about the letter R, because she's thinking, I don't believe people ever pay close attention enough to the alphabet. They don't know what it is or how it works, where it came from. That's a big loss. Maybe I should write something about the letter R. What should I write? I could write a television script, a movie script, a historical novel, a short story, an epic poem. Yeah, I think I'll write a historical novel, the story of R. And so she writes this book, The Story of R. Underline book titles. It's good advice. Story of R by Sally. And like I said, she's a smart one. And she's been reading Mark Twain recently, where Mark Twain says the difference between the right word and almost the right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug, which is a big difference. So she's thinking, I better choose the right word. I better put the right word in the right place every time. And I will not go on until I have found the right word and put it in the right place every time. Because if I pause to find the right word and don't go on until I have found the right word, I will know better not only what I do think, but what I should think. Because verbal precision leads to conceptual precision. Because sloppy language makes sloppy thought possible. So she's really careful and puts the right word in the right place. And as a result, she's able to figure out all sorts of things about R that she wouldn't have figured out if she was more careless and lazy. And so she writes this really good book about R. And let's say that Sam is walking through Barnes and Noble, because Borders closed down, And he goes by the new book table, and he sees the story of R by Sally. And he thinks, R? I've heard of R. This could be good. And he picks it up, and he starts to read. Now, if he's a good reader, he's going to pay really close attention to the verbal cues and clues that she puts for him on the page. Because he knows that meaning is what the author intends, and he wants to find out, what's this Sally up to anyway? And if she's really good at putting the right words in the right order and thinking clearly in order to do it, and if he's a really good reader, he's trying to sort out as best he can, what does she mean by these? Why would she put that word there? If she's good at her job and he's good at his job, the R in her head gets into her book. And if he's a good reader, the R in her book gets into his head. It's communication. It sometimes happens. Not always. Because maybe Sally isn't the smart, careful person I said she was. Maybe she didn't go to the Mark Twain school of writing. Maybe she went to the hand grenade school of writing. Close is good enough. Well, it isn't. Not in writing, anyway. And so, rather than trying to find the right word and put the right word in the right place every time, she just uses any word that comes easily to hand. And all the insight and connections that she could have drawn and seen by choosing the right word and putting it in the right place every time is lost on her because she's too verbally lazy. She hasn't realized that verbal imprecision leads to conceptual imprecision. And although she thinks she's thinking about R, she's really thinking about fuzzy R. She doesn't know it because the problem's in her head. And so she writes a book called R, which is really about fuzzy R. And let's say Sam, who's still a good reader, picks up the book, the fuzzy R book, and he starts to read. And he realizes, oh my gosh, this Sally's nuts. She just said that, and then she said this. You can't possibly say both those things at once. He knows that she's foolish, and she doesn't. Why? Because he pays close attention to her words, and she won't. So you're gonna. He knows that this is all about what she's thinking, and he'll know how good her thought is if he pays close attention to her words. And he knows, oh, that girl does not understand. But let's say Sam's not a good reader. He's a careless reader. He doesn't care if what Sally means, what Sally intends. He won't care if she's been illogical because he won't even notice it because he's sloppy. And so, in the end, the sloppy R that gets into her book, when it comes to Sam, won't be R or sloppy R either. It'll just be T. Because he invented it and put it in the book. And communication doesn't happen. This is the case many times too. And so you have to figure out, how in the world do words work? What's the meaning of meaning? Because if you don't get the meaning of meaning right, you're going to lose the world. Remember all those thought experiments? That's what's going to follow. And some of it's already happened. And it's time to turn the tide on the language. Sloppy language makes sloppy thought possible. So I'm going to press you to come to the right word in the right place every time. Or if you don't, you are part of the problem, not part of the solution. Meaning is not interpretation. Meaning is the author's or the speaker's intention. And your job as an interpreter is to come up with an interpretation as close to what you think they intended as possible. Now, their intention might be mistaken. Maybe your interpretation was actually smarter than their meaning. That isn't the point. The point is, when you read, you have to try to figure out, what's this person up to anyway? What do they mean? And then you decide, is this meaning sensible or not? Meaning is the author's or the speaker's intention. Meaning is not definition. Definition is what you look up in the dictionary. The dictionary definition tells you the standard range of meaning. It tells you how people normally use this word. But what happens if this person is using this old word in a new way? Well, then their meaning isn't the same as the word's definition. If you go by the word's definition, you'll misunderstand the text. Let's say that, as far as we can tell, John Milton in Paradise Lost is the first guy to use the word space the way you and I probably use it, like outer space. But if you looked up in a dictionary the word space in Milton's day in the 1660s and 70s, you wouldn't find that definition, because that's not what he means. He's going to use this old word in a new way. Same with Isaac Newton when he comes up with the theory of gravitation. Newton said he had a hard time with the theory of gravity because he had no word for it. It's hard to think about what you can't name. So he had to find some name for it. So he took the old word gravity and put it to this new use. If you looked up the word gravity in Newton's day, you wouldn't find his meaning there, because meaning isn't definition. Definition is how the words normally use. It's the standard range of meaning. And meaning is what the person who's writing or speaking at the moment intends it to mean. Meaning isn't interpretation. Interpretation is how the reader or the listener understands the text, which might be very, very different from how the author intends the text. And it's not application. Application is how you wisely use or employ the meaning the author intended in the text, which you discerned perhaps by means of definition or interpretation, but your job is to discover what they're up to. And then once you know what they're up to, you'll know what to think about it. Now you have to ask yourself, why is this language stuff so fundamentally important? Here's why language is so fundamentally important. It's important because you live in a universe that was spoken into existence. And that means that God Himself has intimately and enduringly tied the world to words. And if you can't get the words right, you can't get the world right. So master the language. Or, because look, if you haven't mastered the language, how are you going to master the Bible, which comes to you in words? If you haven't mastered language, how are you going to be an evangelist or an apologist for God, because Christianity has a message that needs to be communicated, articulated, and defended. And if you're not good with the words, you're not doing your proper share or filling your proper role in the fallen world. If you haven't mastered the Word, how can you work in the service of Him who is the Word? Speaking about Him, have you ever tried to study how Jesus uses words? Oh, He's really good at this. But then you'd expect it from the guy who invented words. He is the greatest verbal counterpuncher who ever lived. Think of this story that you probably are very familiar with in the gospel. Some his Jewish opponents have caught a woman in the act of adultery, and they bring her to him, and they have this plan in their minds. Let's ask him, what should we do with this woman caught in adultery? If he says, do what the law says and stone her to death, he's going to look terribly merciless, especially in front of all her friends here in the temple courtyard. That won't work well for him. If he says, let her go, then he's going to look like he doesn't care about the law of God right here in the temple courtyard. That won't go well for him. No matter what he does, we've got him. So they bring her this woman, Master, what do you say we should do? And I don't know why, but he kneels down and writes something in the dirt. I don't know what he wrote. I'd like to know. Maybe it was something that he wanted them to read, or maybe he's just doodling to pass time to think about how he wants to respond. We don't know. He just kneeled down and wrote something in the dirt. And then, apparently, when the time was right, he stood up and said, "Let him who's without sin cast the first stone." Which is a brilliant retort, because it keeps the law of God on the one hand and exposes the hypocrisy of her accusers on the other hand. And what I imagine was the sound of silence broken by the sound of rocks falling from guilty hands. They all turned around and walked away, thinking, "We won't try that again." And I'm just saying, if you're supposed to have the mind of Christ, and you are, ask yourself, so how am I doing with the words? Because that's part of the mind of Christ. Master the language. See, here's the choice the world actually gives you. Here's the choice you have. Either you master words, or you'll be mastered by those who do. Pick one. Now, a previous president, probably still fresh in your memory, once said when he was on trial, "It all depends upon what the meaning of the word is. And he was hoping you wouldn't know. And guess what? His defense worked. You have to make sure that stuff like that doesn't get by you anymore. You have to master the words. Now think about, how does Jesus use words? By the way, remember this, he wasn't born being a marvelous rhetorician. It says in Luke that he grew in wisdom and in knowledge and in stature and in favor with God. This is a result of his growth. He grew into this somehow. And you know, if he grows, we should grow too. And we don't know through what process his mind went to figure out how words work. But it went through some process, and this is the end result. Now, just pay careful attention to how Jesus speaks. Did Jesus ever call people names? Oh, yeah. My goodness. He is. He can be just merciless. Imagine you're Peter. You know, it's Matthew 16. And Jesus is asking some questions. He says, "So who do people say that I am?" And Peter, being the most American of the apostles, blurts his answer out first. And so some people say you're this, and some people say you're that, and some people say you're a third thing. And Jesus said, "So who do you say that I am?" And Peter says, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus says, "Good for you, Peter, you know, because that answer didn't come from flesh and blood. It came from my Father in heaven." And then a few verses later, no, because look, Jesus wants people to know who he is. And his disciples, because of Peter, they get it. See, sometimes Peter is capable of remarkable theological insight. And sometimes he's not. So Jesus is going to tell them, "Now that you know who I am, here's what's going to happen. I have to go to Jerusalem and be crucified." And Peter's appalled. He said, "Oh no, far be that from you." And Jesus turns to Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." Yikes. If the Son of God in the flesh calls you Satan in front of your best friends, you've been called something. He'll say things like, he'll call his enemies, you know, they're like whitewashed tombs. You know, they're full of dead men's bones on the outside and the inside, but they're all, you know, slicked up on the outside. Or they're like dirty dishes. All kinds of stuff. He said he calls his enemies sometimes a brood of vipers. You know what a brood of vipers is? It's a bunch of snakes wrapped up into one ball having sex. So you think, that's who they are? Yeah. Jesus said, that's who you are. You should know who you are. Because Because in the right time and place, it's okay to call things by their real names. The problem is we are too quick to do that and often do it at the wrong time and place. We're good at calling people names, but not good at knowing when to do it and how to do it. But he gets it right, and your job is to figure out, how does he do this? See, when I read the Gospels, this often happens to me. I see him say something, and I realize, I wouldn't have said that. And then I realize, what's wrong with me? And I have to sit down and think, so where should my mind have been in order to say the sort of thing he said? Because until I can get my mind where his was, I don't really have the mind of Christ, and my job here is not done. So I'm trying to figure out, how does that mind work and how does that mind use words? Your job is the same thing. How do you master language? Now, I would say this. The Western tradition has tried to figure out how to teach people how to use words, which is why education in the West begins with what they call the trivium, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. Grammar, you start with grammar, because grammar's how to write a sentence. Grammar's how to think a complete thought. You probably heard that a sentence is a complete thought. Now, what if you can't write a sentence? Well, then you might have trouble thinking a complete thought, but you wouldn't know that. That's why, at least in theory, we all started out at grammar schools. But sadly, grammar schools are too often a grammar-free zone. And so you didn't master grammar. Well, let's say you were absent the day they did prepositions. You know, prepositions make understanding relationships possible. Of, from, by, for, with, etc. If you haven't mastered prepositions, you can't understand relationships. That's a really big loss. Or maybe you didn't go to class the day they talked about adjectives and adverbs. Well, an adjective is a characteristic of a noun, a thing. Adverb is a characteristic of an action. If you don't see the connection between nouns and their attributes and actions and their attributes, you're going to miss a whole lot in the world. And maybe you haven't mastered, say, the active voice or indirect and direct causation. Then you won't know who's doing what to whom. That's a big loss. Now, maybe you go to a church, you know, like me, an evangelical church, and you've learned how to pray in evangelicalese. That's not good news either, because you tend to pray in the subjunctive mood and the passive voice. And you'll say things like, "Oh God, what wouldst thou have us to do?" When you mean, "God, what do you want?" Why can't you just say that? But we pray in these circuitous circumlocutions, and I'm saying that's going to foul up the way you pray and the way you understand God's actions in your life. Put the right word in the right place and you'll do better. So you master grammar. Grammar's how to speak, how to write a sentence. But you're not done just because you've mastered grammar. You have to go on to dialectic. Dialectic is not how to speak, but how to speak sense. It's not how to write a sentence, it's how to write a paragraph, how to put sentences together, how to make a case. Because if you can make a case, you can make a difference. And so you have to manage or master the grammar, how to speak and how to write a sentence, and the dialectic, how to speak sense and write a paragraph. But even then you're not done, because you go from grammar to dialectic to rhetoric. If grammar is how to speak and dialectic is how to speak sense, rhetoric is how to speak sense beautifully, memorably, and compellingly. And if you can do that, you have a shot at changing the world. Now, go learn your words and your grammar. Now, people ask me, well, who should I read? Well, if you haven't read a grammar book, you need to read a grammar book. and master what's in there. There aren't any shortcuts. But once you've read your grammar book, you're not done. I would say, go read this fellow, Richard Mitchell. Richard Mitchell died a few years ago. He used to teach classics at Glassboro State in New Jersey, which I think is now called Rowan University. And Mitchell was appalled by the mental condition of the students that came to him in his freshman classes. And he thought, what can I do about this? So he came up with a plan. He said, I think I'm going to start a newspaper. He called it the Underground Grammarian. He said, what I want people to do is I want people to send me the documents, like the memos, the newspaper editorials, the articles written by the people in the public school system, the superintendents, the principals, the history teachers, the football coaches. Just send me what they write. Because I'm going to publish them verbatim. And then I will take those things apart word by word so that you can see that the people in charge of the life of the mind in America are nincompoops. I will fry the fools in their own juices and I will hang them with their own rope. And so he gets these things sent to him and he publishes them for 15 years in the Underground Grammarian. He takes some of the best of those Underground Grammarian pieces and collects them into a book called Less Than Words Can Say. Find that book. It's very much worth reading. Now, it's easier to find that book than you might think, even though the book's out of print, because if you went to the Underground Grammarian online, all Richard's books are free for downloading. You can just download them for nothing. All 15 years under the Underground Grammarian are available to download for free. You've heard of people talk about the great books. Well, he has something called the great booklets, and you should read those too. And they're free for download. I'm saying that if Richard Mitchell wrote it, you should probably read it. When you see what he does to the language of the educationists, then you'll know what you should do to your language before you make it public and save yourself all the embarrassment. Because guys like Mitchell are going to be out there waiting for you. And so learn from a guy like Mitchell who understands how to put words under really careful scrutiny. And you need to do this to you. I tell my students that you are old enough to have learned this lesson. You're old enough to have learned to thank God for your enemies. Because your enemies, if you have a weakness, will gladly point it out to you. Thank them for it. Your friends won't be able to point out your blind spots because they probably have the same ones and can't see them. And they might be polite and not tell you anyway. So, yeah, thank God for enemies. Now, that made sense to me when I was younger. I didn't become a Christian until I was in my third year of college. And at that point, I was either going to be a lawyer for the ACLU and work for the American Indians, or else be a track coach. I hadn't decided. But once I became a Christian, all that changed. So I thought, what am I going to do now? And I just had to start working through this thing step by step and word by word. And I decided that I should be an evangelical professor. And I thought, if I'm going to be an evangelical professor, I would be better served to go to places where my view wasn't the party line. So I went to a liberal seminary and to a Roman Catholic graduate school. That way, if I had blind spots, they'd happily point them out to me. And I could return the favor. I mean, at that liberal seminary, I was in a course on the book of Acts, and the professor said, nobody here believes in the literal resurrection, do they? I said, yeah, I do. He said, why? And I explained, you know, about the historical evidence. And there was a woman sitting next to me who was going to be a Presbyterian pastor. And she said, I don't really care about the historical resurrection. I've had an experience, and I want to communicate it to people. I said, if Jesus does not exist as a personal entity after death, on what basis would you call your experience Christian. Because Christ isn't around. What are you experiencing? She didn't like the question. So you learn to thank God for your enemies because they'll point your errors out for you. Now, in a sense, you have to strike this pose, the pose where you are your own enemy. Put on the hat of your enemy and look at the things you've written and the things you've thought and try to put them under a sort of withering critique. Because if you can't survive your own withering critique, you won't survive anybody else's. And so I'm just saying, be your own drill instructor and prepare yourself for combat or die. Now, is there anything you want to say or ask before we go on?
I'm going to subvert you just a moment. I would like to have you comment for just 1 second about why, what have we lost as we've stopped teaching grammar in a lot of our schools?
What have we lost because we have let grammar and things of that sort go? We have lost the power of thought. Here's why. When the power of words is small, the power of thought is small. And we have lots of young people who do not have power over the words. They can't put the right word in the right place. They can use the word like 7 times in a sentence, but in no case is it used as a simile. They live in a grammar-free zone, which means they live in a largely logic-free zone. You must understand that language is a logic. The rules of grammar aren't arbitrary. They developed over the centuries because these rules helped to make clear thought and precise communication possible. You must master the rules, and they don't, and they don't want to, and they haven't been required to. And as a result, they've lost the power of thought and all sorts of power of insight. Their minds aren't able to cut right through to the heart of the issue because their minds haven't been taught to do such things. I think you're first. Go ahead.
I'm trying to work through the idea of some of us common people that don't have exceptional computers for brains and that haven't done this work about mastering language. Where does that leave the common man in terms of being able to communicate ideas that he might have floating around but not having mastered this? I agree that we really
it
should...
It leaves them hindered in some way.
But does it leave them voiceless?
No, not voiceless, but less effective than they could have been otherwise. No one is born a rhetorical genius. Everybody had to learn this sometime after birth, if they learned it at all. Now, because you are made in the image of God, remember how it says in Genesis 1, let's make man in our image? Well, think about it. All you know about God at that point in the Bible is he is an articulate communal maker. He makes worlds with words, and you should be like him. You should master words because by your words you make worlds, worlds of thought. Worldviews. And if your language is confused and contradictory, the worldview that you'll be building will be confused and contradictory, and you would be ill-advised to invite people into that world and to look around and say, this is God's world. It isn't. So in order to be like God, you're going to have to master the words in order to make these worlds of thought into which you want to invite people to come. Now, it's still possible to be an effective witness for God or an agent of God's working and not be rhetorically adept. Think of Moses, not so skillful with the words, but good in many other ways. If you find yourself not so skillful with the words, well, then be sure you find yourself skillful in other ways. But I'm saying that this word thing is so important because the world came from it, that you don't want to overlook it. And since you're made in God's image, you probably have more capacities here than you think. I don't mean you personally, but we all, since we're in God's image.
We were talking earlier this morning at breakfast that we live in a culture that is, you got under 6 seconds to make a profound statement to reach on a very general, broad level. And everyone feels like they have to post a comment on their Facebook or have a bumper sticker on their car that's going to say what they want to say. But the scripture says, let not many of you be teachers, knowing that you will be held to a stricter judgment.
Yep.
And if our enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink.
I agree.
By doing so, you will keep heap coals upon his head. So at what times are we more wise to simply keep our mouths shut?
I couldn't tell you that ahead of time. I'd have to know the situation. That is, details count. And then there's no rule of thumb that I could establish. Say, no, in these situations, do X. In those situations, do Y. And in the third set of situations, do Z. It doesn't reduce to any kind of an outline. So I couldn't answer the question. I don't mean to be vague, but I don't think it's possible to answer the question.